Today on the Monocle Weekly, edition 121, we talk with Iceland's president to find out why he's inviting tourists into his home and encouraging his fellow countrymen to do the same.
This effort is especially dedicated to make people realize that the autumn and the early winter months are really a fascinating time to be in Iceland.
That was Icelandic President Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson, and we discover why Rio de Janeiro's opted for high-tech military machinery to patrol its streets from the sky in advance of the 2014 World Cup.
They have these big world events coming up, and they need to show the world that they're really serious about being tough and cracking down on crime.
That was our defense correspondent Trevor Moss, and we hear from noted photographer Terence Simon, who is one of the speakers at this year's Freeze Art Fair.
We were discussing the possibilities and difficulties of image production today.
And now, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, October 16th, 2011, and you're with the Monocle Weekly with me, Tyler Brulé, editor Andrew Tuck, and Mr. Robert Bound. I'm looking at you, Rob, but I actually want to speak to Andrew first.
That's kind of weird.
I know.
And this is a great radio joke.
I know, but there's so many microphones in the way that...
it's like a forest.
It's a wandering eye, isn't it? These microphones are much higher than I'm used to, but we'll get there, won't
we? It makes
you
sit up straight. It's good for your back.
You're very wrecked, yeah, wrecked this morning.
Perky.
Andrew,
yes.
How's your week been?
Nuts.
It's not been busy, has it?
It's been a little bit nuts. It's been very exciting, but slightly crazy.
Yeah.
It's just been obviously getting everything ready for tomorrow morning and
yes.
for the amazing launch of Monocle 24. But it's just been so many things happened. Two of my the things that are kind of highlighted the extremes of things that can happen in a week when you're setting up a radio station was one when somebody asked me very sensibly, did they think I should hire a goat? Which I won't reveal why that the goat question came up.
No, absolutely. But that was one of the
questions.
Please don't spoil my program.
No. And then there was another. Then in the very same day, we had like Brazil's Tina Turner rock up in the office for like the craziest moment as well. So there's just been so many things going on. It's bordered on the surreal sometimes.
How is Brazil's Tina Turner? Who is she?
She's called Elsa Suarez. I'm sorry, my accent there's a bit bad murdering the Portuguese.
Your accent's a bit bad after 5
bottles of wine. She is a 74-year-old woman who's been famous in Brazil for 50 years. She's got a growl on her like a tiger.
A growl?
Very deep. And she's an old lady. And she sits in this chair and you see this kind of woman who looks a little bit frail. And then she starts singing. What's amazing is that she, well, Robin won't know more about this than me, but she mixes in very contemporary music with traditional Brazilian music. And I think everyone was a bit excited, you know, unsure when she started, but once she got going, it was absolutely incredible.
Like Bedlam, but in a good way.
Well, I heard it was quite a cavalcade of people, but we'll have a little bit more on that later in the week. But Rob, I guess you've had your feet up all week, haven't you?
Yeah, I've not been there much. I interviewed Elsa. I think that's going to pop up somewhere later on another show.
Right.
So that was cool. But it's just, I think it's been a little bit like Andrew, only not with quite the same hours. Not quite so nut. I'm not so much of a Brazil nut, a smaller nut, a less significant one.
Are we going to be doing a preview of what both of you gentlemen will be doing on this 24-hour schedule of ours later in the show?
Yeah, let's talk about it later in the show.
Are you going to need a holiday, do you think, Andrew, at some point?
I don't think that's on the schedule.
2026, you've got booked in.
Yes. Yeah, I think you probably
do. That
was
an afternoon that I saw looked available.
should we talk about what we're going to do for our first story?
Okay.
Yeah?
Let's get ready.
Everyone traveling to a new country tries to get to the heart of what makes a place tick, whether it's coming to terms with the fact that in Italy, cappuccinos after breakfast time are a faux pas, or in Brazil, as we were discussing, it's okay to wear flip-flops to dinner. For Icelandic President Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson, getting an authentic experience means staying in an Icelander's home, and he's setting the example, opening up his residence to a few lucky tourists, and he's already convinced some of his high-powered friends and colleagues and other countrymen to do the same. President Grímsson joins us on the line now from Reykjavik. Hello, President Grímsson. I wanted to start, are the beds already made and are you ready to welcome the world?
Iceland is always ready to welcome the world, but this effort is especially dedicated to make people realize that the autumn and the early winter months are really a fascinating time to be in Iceland, both with respect to the nature, the culture, the society, and therefore families and homes are part of this effort.
It's an incredible concept. I wanted to start. Did this is something that was dreamt up in Parliament, or did you have to hire a very expensive consulting firm in London or New York to dream this up?
No, we get all kinds of good ideas in Iceland. And as you know, we suffered a banking crisis 3 years ago. Then we got the eruption in Eyjafjallajökull, which created a lot of us in our own country, as well as disturbing the air traffic all over Europe for a number of days. And then we had another eruption earlier this year. So we felt it necessary to really make the world understand that Iceland is a perfectly safe place, a fascinating place. So we started this campaign inspired by Iceland, dedicated to the summer tourism, and the result was extraordinary. It seems that 2010 and 2011 will be the best tourism years ever in Iceland. But as we get into the winter, which for us in Iceland is a great time, I mean, family time, social time, cultural time, and outdoor time. We said, why don't we make people realize that they can also come to Iceland during this time of the year? And we do it by doing for them what we do for ourselves. So that is really the essence of how Iceland creates hospitality for our foreign guests. And therefore, this idea came up that why don't get a number of Icelanders, ordinary people, people from different parts of the country, and why not get the president and the ministers and the mayor and others involved? And I thought it was a brilliant idea, absolutely brilliant idea, and therefore I said yes immediately.
Your forefathers have something of a reputation for invading people, so I'm wondering who's invading you? What countries have really taken up, the invitation so far?
Well, the major European countries like Britain, Germany, the Nordic countries have always been very strong in terms of visits to Iceland. But this year and last year, the United States has come in a big way. We have had, for example, this summer four flights a day between Reykjavik and New York, which is, in fact, sort of extraordinary when you look at it. So we are now getting more people from America, and they also love this whole idea of getting close to the people, being welcomed in an open way.
And finally, just before we go, can I choose who I stay with? If I wanted to stay with your foreign minister, for example, can I put in a request? I mean, not just me, of course.
The foreign minister is a great host. He's a good friend of mine, and he would treat you to all kinds of things, inviting you to play chess and go for walks and listen to his daughters play and so on. But let me make this sure. We are not inviting people to stay overnight. We invite them into our home. We give them some great Icelandic products, whether it is vegetables from the greenhouses or Icelandic chocolate, which is absolutely fantastic. Many people don't realize that, in fact. And then we invite them to join in what we do ourselves, whether it's to enjoy the nature, go for a walk, listen to some music, or even read from the books. You might know that Iceland is the country of honor at the world-famous Frankfurter Book Fair now. So people can be expected to be treated to culture as well as extraordinary food and the hospitality of the people. And I will tell the foreign minister that you definitely want to pay him a visit. He lives close to the ocean and the western part of Reykjavik, so you would also have a fantastic view from his window. You could even see the famous Snæfells Glacier, which features very prominently in Jules Verne's book, Journey to the Center of the Earth.
President Grimson, be careful what you wish for. I might be moving in. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Rob, what do you think? Would I be good playing with the daughters, do you think? Are they inviting us over just to entertain? Because I thought, you know, I'd probably just like reading for the kids and babysitting. So it actually works both ways.
I know. Well, you're singing for your supper, aren't you, kind of really? But you might have to. Going for a walk sounds all right. We like the kind of Icelandic scenery. But I don't know whether the chess would suit me.
I don't know. I like it. I haven't played chess for a while, but he made it sound incredibly cozy and inviting, didn't he, Andrew?
Yeah, it's obviously a kind of real kind of winter thing. They kind of want to get people in there, but they were one of the most exciting pursuits where you can sit around with us and read a book if you want, and you could perhaps play chess. But
I quite like that. That's what I want to do for winter, lo-fi winter.
but not with people you don't know. Coming to our lounge, we're not going to talk to you, but do you want to read a book?
No, but I think
that's one of the main features on the New Culture Show. But Andrew,
Jim, he did sell us on the foreign minister.
Yeah,
and the view sounds good.
Yeah, it's great. It's, you know, they obviously all know each other because it's such a country of 300,000 people. Yeah, that's it. I know his house.
Larry, the foreign minister. Exactly. No problems.
Well, I would hope the president knows him well. Anyway, off we go. I think they're calling our flight to Reykjavik as we speak.
Hear it coming in.
Exactly. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly from London. We're back after this.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. Rio de Janeiro has some big events lined up, the Football World Cup in 2014 and the Summer Olympics 2 years after that. Fearful of terrorist attacks when the crowds descend on the city, they're taking to the skies to keep Rio safe by using military-style drones. But is this taking a step too far, or are we in an era when a city's security is really all-out war? In the studio is our defence correspondent, Trevor Moss. Trevor, thanks so much for coming to see us. First of all, can I just ask you about these drones? Is this really the first time that we've seen them used in a civilian setting?
I think it is quite a new thing we're seeing. I mean, I think we're quite used to watching militaries at this point using unmanned technology to take out terrorists or the Taliban in the case of Afghanistan. But it's very unusual for internal security and essentially policing to be done using UAVs, unmanned aerial vehicles. And I think partly that reflects Brazil's specific situation. They have obviously a big problem with gangs, and I think they've had some specific cases of police helicopters being taken out from the ground. And obviously they're worried about that from the loss of life perspective and from the cost perspective. But also it's important for them. They have these big world events coming up, and they need to show the world that they're really serious about being tough and cracking down on crime, and B, you know, not just being seen to do it, but actually to do it, because the crime statistics, I think, are pretty horrendous.
And tell me, actually, just in a kind of a basic sense, what can they actually achieve, these drones? Is it mainly sending back kind of images back to a police station? What can they really do?
It's all about surveillance. I mean, I don't think we're talking about weaponized drones at this point, such as the Americans deploy in Afghanistan. So we're not actually going to see these things firing missiles anywhere. But what they really offer you is the ability to, you know, loiter over your target for an extremely long period of time, sort of depending on the system, maybe 20, 24 hours or something like that. And they also go very high up, so you don't even know they're there. And they just sit up there and watch these targets on the ground, and you can pull in all that information and you know exactly what's going on.
So I'm a terrorist trying to smuggle guns into the city. What detail can that drone see me? And would I be aware that it was hovering above me? Would I see it? Would I hear it?
It could potentially be about 7,000 metres up, so you'd have no idea that it was there. And the resolution and the radar that these things have are extremely sophisticated. I think one thing that Brazil does have a problem with is surveillance in jungle, because I don't think they've quite got the technology to punch through that yet and to really see what's going on underneath the canopy. But in the city, I can see it being extremely useful for getting a handle on what's going on in those favelas, which are sort of like warrens, I think.
Trevor, it was some time ago we did a piece that also Rio went and bought an armoured Twin Huey, and turn that into a proper gunship. So very, very, very heavily armed. Do you think that we will see, and gunships aside, but that we'll see more UAVs? You know, if this works well in Rio, I could imagine if you've got to police something the size of Seoul or Los Angeles, that this will soon become the norm rather than just putting up choppers at a point.
It's very interesting that it's being used in an urban context. I think previously people thought it would be useful for quite big empty countries who, sort of take a Mongolia, for example, that has these huge empty spaces. And maybe the urban environment wasn't what people imagined at first, but obviously Brazil are taking the first step, and really this is a test case. If we see that it is an effective tool in tackling these gangs, and I think a lot of other cities, although there aren't probably many cities that have the problem on that scale, you probably will see others following suit.
And have they named who won the contract yet?
Yeah, it's going to an Israeli company. I think the Israelis are, along with the Americans, are the world leaders in this field. So it's not a great surprise that it's gone to them. I think the Israelis fought pretty hard for the business.
And I'm wondering if sort of potentially Embraer is looking for some technology transfer to the market maybe as well, if they learn from this.
That's exactly right. I think they are already setting up a UAV unit to really capitalize on this technology they're going to be getting.
And can you just tell me a little bit more? So the Israelis are obviously leading the way here. But are there other countries who are kind of as good as the Israelis now?
The Americans and the Israelis are in the lead at the moment, and I think probably not too far behind them are the Chinese and some European countries, including the UK, is building a system. But the Israelis is pretty much top-notch. Mm.
And if it ever came to Europe, do you think there would be, there would just be too many kind of civil rights questions that no one here would ever be able to do it? Or do you think that actually in the future we'll also see them perhaps hovering over London ahead of the Olympics?
I think there'd be serious issues with that. I mean, there is the Big Brother aspect to it. You have these things hovering overhead on a non-stop basis, pretty much watching what you're doing. And I think people would probably have an issue with that. It's one thing to send a helicopter up to deal with a specific situation, but to have these things just hovering above you 24/7, I think people would probably draw the line at that in London, for example.
Especially over London, where they're not very keen even on planes coming in to land at Heathrow at the moment. So they'd probably in a holding pattern, wouldn't they, the drones? They'd be hovering around for several hours before they could come in and across the city.
But it was funny because being in the centre of London, certainly during the riots, you had helicopters from the Met, which were just in their stationary positioning all night. So maybe actually a drone at 7,000 metres would be better than a Met chopper at 700 feet.
And more cost effective, probably. I mean, they're certainly a lot cheaper to run. They just hover up there, with not using too much energy for a long time. And I think that's probably one of the reasons that the Brazilians wanted to do this. It's in the long run, it's going to be quite a cheap way to do it.
So you could imagine there's going to be the mayor's office or certainly the police chief's office are going to be hosting a lot of other governments and cities are going to be watching closely now.
I think that's true. The opportunities there, there's certainly a huge range of technologies, the tiny little things that you can fit in a backpack, ranging up to huge jumbo jet size things. So certainly cities could probably find the right solution to meet their needs if they felt that they wanted to go down that route.
Good. Well, we'll be keeping an eagle eye on the skies over the coming months. Trevor Moore, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here in London. We're back in a moment.
You're back with Monocle Weekly here in London. Well, the Frieze Art Fair ended today, but the art world barely takes a breath before FIAC strikes up in Paris. But has the art business bounced back, or was it another year of conservative parties and paltry sales? Culture editor Rob Bound was just across Marylebone Road and in the park. I mean, we should be actually sort of hosting part of Frieze this time next year, shouldn't we?
We should do, yeah. I think we can...
The satellite office, satellite branch.
Yeah, exactly. We've got some nice things to hang on the walls as well.
We've got a couple of nice things already on the wall, don't we?
Exactly. Sideline.
Yes.
Yeah?
I didn't even get there this year. I ran past it several times. Looked nice from afar. No, I thought
the tent is good this year. It's good tenting.
Good. What's the update?
There's no joking. I don't know why you're smirking.
No.
I think the patient is in a year older, but still in rude health. I think the art market probably might at some point, will, I suppose, inevitably at some point, reflect what might be happening in Greece and in Europe. But at the moment, it's such an international market, especially in London, that maybe it's not. Maybe we haven't quite caught that cold yet.
Is it the big draw? Because it's interesting how you hear that Madrid really pushing their fair, and of course FIAC in Paris as well. But when you look at the European calendar, is this it? Or even internationally, would you say?
I think it's definitely the cream of the crop. In FIAC is slightly different, and it can afford to be slightly different coming straight. It starts this week. It's on now. It'll be
just
starting as
French.
Soon as Frieze. It's got a different idea to it. It's a bit more modern as opposed to just contemporary. So it's kind of different flavour, and it's quite a Gallic show. Quite a lot of French galleries in there.
You don't say.
So Frieze, I think, is the leader of the European pack for sure, and it's always squabbling with New York, but as an art city, but as a selling art city, as an art fair city. New York's never quite got its act together with the Armory, which is why Frieze are presumably setting up their New York fair next March, I think it is.
And do you think part of it is quite literally because they do pitch a tent?
Yeah, I.
No, because
we always like, no, but there's something about that.
No, because they create a sense of occasion, and as wonderful as the Armory is in New York, the Armory's sort of there, and there's a certain occasion because it is the circus coming to town, and, and is there value in that?
Yeah, I think there definitely is value in that, and I think people are, they can tinker with it every year. It looks slightly different, it's slightly bigger, it's got slightly different things going on, you know, under the. Under the marquee.
No, I like the notion of tinkering with your tent.
Tinkering with your tent, exactly. It's just an itch. And I think that does have a, I think there is a sense of occasion about it rocking up and it being there for a week and then it disappearing again. I think there is a thing. I think it makes it's good for tourism.
They already revealed is that what's going to happen in New York? Will the circus come to town or are they going to go to an existing space? Do we know yet?
It's going to be on Randall's Island and I think it's going to be a tent as well. Yeah. I think it's kind of like a brand for them, isn't it? You know, it's sort of, that's how it works. But yeah, and this year it was a better place to be. The lighting was much better. It felt much less like a supermarket. The aisles were wider.
Well, I thought they also did more actually just with the approach and didn't you know, go beyond the threshold. But as I sprinted past my Asics, it looked
There were two. There was like a Deutsche Bank VIP entrance, which looked slightly for, but it was like the grey carpet, you know. and then there was the regular punters entrance, which they've done really nice things with. They've done projects. It's a sort of well-honed show. So it's much less rough around the edges than it used to be, unless it means to be.
I went with Rob but I got there so late. In fact, we only had time to go to the bar.
And then damn shame, Andrew.
This surprises the editor-in-chief very much. did we manage to chat to anyone, by any chance?
Yeah, we met. Before we do that, can we also just say that we met at one of our former colleagues who left 2 weeks ago, standing on a stand.
And how was he?
Yeah,
he looked very smart and very. Yeah, he looked happy, but he couldn't come with us to the bar. That was what I was missing this year.
I know
he was on a bit of a leash, wasn't he?
Yes, he had to behave.
Yes, it's funny. It's funny seeing with him the exhibitor's badge on rather than the press pass in his hand.
Oh,
but yeah,
Mr. Tommy.
I think they. I think Maureen Paley did quite well as well. Good gallery. And who else did we? Well, I went off. I beetled off with. One of our sound recording units. And so I was genuinely quite a busy beast. We spoke to one of the directors, Amanda Sharp. We spoke to the curator of the Frieze project, Sarah McCrory. We spoke to Anahita Razmi, who won the M-Dash Award to do one of the Frieze projects. And we spoke to our friend Stephen Friedman, who's always good for a pithy soundbite.
Oh, it's because he's Canadian.
Yeah. He knows what's expected of him.
Absolutely.
He needs a sting. and then I'm going to carry on. I'm talking about art.
No, but it says you're
missing the link.
What about Taran Simon?
Sorry. It wasn't only me with a sound recorder out this week. How about that for a segue?
He's back
I'm
now.
Looking through the glass. We sent out one of our new radio crew, Thea Erdal, to catch up with Taran Simon about our new project in Berlin and what she's up to here at Frieze.
Photographer Taran Simon is a rarity. The New York-based artist is known for sourcing stories both strange and arresting, and her latest exhibition, A Living Man Declared Dead and Other Chapters, recently opened at the Neue Nationalgalerie in Berlin after a stint at Tate Modern. Monocle caught up with Simon on the leafy grounds of Frieze Art Fair this week.
A Living Man Declared Dead is a project I produced over the last 4 years in which I traveled around the world and I recorded different bloodlines and their related stories. What I was interested in these stories were considerations of fate and whether one's fate is determined by blood or chance or circumstance. And I kind of had the representation of order through a bloodline butting up against the disorder that's established in the stories that I'm documenting.
A Living Man consists of masterly curated visual and textual landscapes portraying feuding families in Brazil, victims of genocide in Bosnia, the body double of Saddam Hussein's son, Uday, and the living dead in India. Simon is fascinated by issues of power, mainly American, and has previously gained access to enclosed sanctums such as the Ku Klux Klan and the Church of Scientology.
In the new project, there's a lot of attention to this idea of absence and presence, and that was a part of my past work as well. I mean, that one of the most important works in an American index was actually a rejection from one of the sites I was trying to enter into, which was from Disney. And they sent me this letter that said, during these violent times, people need a fantasy that they can escape to, which became so much more valuable than any photograph I could have ever produced. In this new work, the absences are linked to people who couldn't be photographed for one reason or another. So either declined participation, had dengue fever, military imprisonment, women who couldn't be allowed, weren't allowed out of the house for religious or social reasons, or something really banal like plastic surgery appointment, and depending on where I was. And those absences in many ways took on more weight than the actual presences.
Photography is in Simon's blood, and her immensely curious nature stems from her upbringing. Her father worked for the government and often ventured to distant and dangerous places, bringing home vast amounts of photographs for the young Taran.
My introduction to photography started with my grandfather and father, both of whom are avid photographers. My grandfather built telescopes, and he was extremely interested in the natural world, but in a sort of microscopic dissection of it. So it was either the stars or insects or molecules. And my father was traveling to a lot of regions that were quite complicated and bringing back images of those journeys. And that was kind of how I got to know the larger world.
Taran Simon is one of the biggest names on the international art photography scene. She is represented by Gagosian Gallery, and her work has been acquired by leading institutions such as the MoMA, the Getty Museum in Los Angeles, and the V&A in London, manifesting her position as one of our finest contemporary storytellers.
Taran Simon was speaking to Thea Erdal there. Taran Simon is one of those people that can talk for, I don't know, 5 minutes there without pausing, hesitating, umming, ahhing,
what
deviating.
What are you saying? There was absolutely no editing there. Is that what you're saying?
I said that's a pretty good interview technique of Taya's, actually. But are you familiar with Taran Simon's work?
Yes.
She's cool. She's young. She's kind of, I think she's born in
1960. You say like young, like what young people can do art? What do you mean?
I think she's got like an amazingly impressive and sort of mature body of work for someone that's her age, and is unafraid to be serious and do serious things and have a serious intent with it, and also a refreshing lack of ego. She was sort of saying, I want to take myself out of the work as much as possible.
She was quite disdainful of people going for plastic surgery. You could certainly hear that in the interview.
Yeah, she wasn't keen for you missing her, but your picture portrait for...
I know, exactly. It was a veritable snort she gave for the word plastic surgery. But I like her sort of photos that she used to take of sort of impossible places, of like the insides of nuclear power stations and high security places and slightly sad zoos, which aren't impossible places but are a bit sad.
And also not far away in the park as well. Actually, on that note, they've actually built a whole new pen beside the giraffes at Regent's Park. I don't know. I mean, there's no signs, and I thought that if I was one of those animals, and freeze was going on. I mean, A, you're competing with the giraffes.
Yeah.
Behind on the canal is where the warthogs are, which I
love.
Like.
They're my favourites.
Yeah, and they're sort of out in the suburbs, and I was wondering if there's a big discussion at the zoo. No, because you would have to think, like, because this is really free viewing, in fact, because you're beside the giraffes. You get to pick the giraffes in the morning for free, but they've built a little mound for these guys, whoever they're going to be.
They're one of their meerkats.
They could be meerkats. It looks like meerkat territory.
What else? Like some sort of mound.
I like running because you also see the kangaroos. The kangaroos come up quite close when you go around the corner.
Really?
You can see kangaroos.
You must run a different way.
Yeah.
But there are also things like cows and sheep because
they've
got a children's
zoo. It's a bit pedestrian. I don't like
petting
that.
Zoo.
Actually, me and Rob had this argument once before because in the office he thought it was actually quite nice to have a pig in a zoo.
I told you about the warthogs. I've done that walk. I used to do that walk quite regularly.
I have a lot of time for the warthogs.
Yeah, they're amazing. I think it's amazing. I think London Zoo should, take them out of the suburbs.
I think tomorrow morning.
You can look at those for free.
I think we have a live spot for tomorrow morning. Just sort of peek over the pen. See who's there.
Peek over the pen.
I think peek over the pen's a great segment.
That's such a good breakfast show idea. I love that. I can't wait to go and record this. Can I record the sounds?
Absolutely.
Brilliant.
Do we need to rent a goat for it?
What's all the goat chat?
Oh, just you wait till Friday. Just wait till my program.
I think we kept on brand about the Taran Simon work, didn't we?
Absolutely.
Yes. Exactly.
Nowhere else in the show, but just for that bit.
Just for that bit. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly still. We're back in a moment.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. Well, to kick off our culture section, we head back in time with Taylor Timothy Everest for the next in our series of Brands Remembered.
My name's Timothy Everest. I'm a bespoke tailor based in Spitalfields, London. I'd like to talk about someone I used to work with called Tommy Nutter. It's a brand that I think was very relevant in its time and someone that I was very fond of. In a way, he was a brand before brands became very established. And he was a tailor on Savile Row who had a fantastic repertoire. So people like the Beatles, if you look at Abbey Road, all the album cover, they're all wearing his stuff. And he used to dress people like Bianca Jagger and so on. But he was very much a human and young, youthful face of bespoke tailoring and was very well recognised around the world. When I think back about Tommy, I worked with him in the 80s, so it was a very exciting time for me because when I was working there, people like John Galliano on placement from St Martin's. So that sort of period of the 80s was great fun because it was about being an individual and sort of dressing up, bleaching one's hair and wearing oversized suits. But it was a very interesting kind of period. And for me, it was kind of interesting to see how brands were starting to take off and personalities, particularly brands like Comme des Garçons and brands like Ralph Lauren were still very much in their infancy. And I've always felt that Tommy was one of those people that, had he lived, could have been a brand that would have been very relevant to today, because he certainly was at that time.
That was London tailor Timothy Everest. Andrew, you used to go to Timothy, didn't you? Or do you still do?
I haven't been for a while, but I was addicted to Timothy Everest.
Yeah.
As an amazing tailor. And I used to like going there because he's in this wonderful old house in Elder Street in Spitalfields. And I don't know, it was almost like going to a gentleman's club or something. It was like quite relaxing and you could sit on the sofa and he was made it very kind of casual process. Yeah, and I think he's a very talented man.
Yeah. I used to go to Timothy quite a bit as well. I don't know what, I mean, I get my suits made in Japan now, but no, I just have to justify because Timothy's going to listen, and I found some wonderful tailors in Japan.
Maybe I'll go.
You want to?
I'll go. I'll keep the.
I know that also. Timothy was looking in our area. I thought he was going to maybe open something in West London.
I think the downfall was coming to this office actually because it's not a very suit office here. It's more a jacket office. That. So it was.
Better send your CV out.
Okay, he would have made half the amount of money from me because I wouldn't have needed the trousers.
Just
anymore.
No trousers.
Yeah.
They call you no pants for nothing. No. I like that we had a Timothy Everest addiction as well. It starts with a cufflink.
Well, it is.
It's a slippery slope.
Hold on. The reason it becomes an addiction because if you're not a very tall or regular sized person, so I'm not the tallest person in the office, that when you go there and you suddenly have something that when you collect it literally fits you perfectly, you think, oh my God, I can't go back and
buy something. I don't think I'd be so thrilled if I was Timothy listening to this because you're going to think he's like a tailor who does petites only.
Yeah. It's just a bit.
Timothy Everest for petites.
Timothy Everest, the irony is in the surname. More of a Monroe than a mountain.
Do you have a song to go with that?
I've got a song. We've got a new record by Pink Martini and Saori Yuki.
I'm liking the sound of it already.
So we like Pink Martini. They're mates from Portland, Maine, and Portland, Oregon.
Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. I should always just read the script.
You should.
Freestyle.
Okay, I'll help you on the coast.
All right. And they've teamed up with Saori Yuki, who I think is a sort of cross between a Marianne Faithfull and a kind of Shirley Bassey character in
Not
Japan.
Not the Tina Turner of Japan.
No. Not every country can have a Tina Turner.
They certainly
it's
can.
Not Japan's time.
No.
They've made a record called 1969, which consists of tracks written in that year and that sort of adapt the vibe of
this
that
year. After I was born.
It's a classic year.
It is.
The year after you were born. Yeah.
I just thought I'd throw that in.
Yeah, a couple of years before I was born.
Oh my God, it's a Sunday comedy show. There it is. Let's hear the song, shall we?
The song is called Mayonaka no Bossa Nova.
Shada-ba-ba-ya-shada-ba-ya-fa-fa. Mayonaka ni onna hitori de kiku uta wa.
How do we like that?
Well, it's very Pizzicato 5.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
It's very Pizzicato 5. Have we played Pizzicato 1 yet? Did we play it a few weeks ago? No, we didn't.
No, we haven't. We've had it on the office, but not on the radio.
Well, we will very soon.
Let's have it on the radio.
It's going to be a bit of a Pizzicato week, I think.
It's a Pizzicato off.
No, I love that. Is the rest of the album like that?
Yeah, it's really nice. She's cool.
Yeah.
There's a strange but charming rendition of Puff the Magic Dragon halfway through. Really? Sung in French, Japanese and English.
Oh my God. I love Frappanese.
It's, yeah.
Frappanese is good.
It is. It does. It's frothy. So that's it. And also, we should slightly big them up. They're playing the Albert Hall on October the 17th. There might still be tickets available.
That's a small venue. On October when?
October 17th.
That's tomorrow.
Is it?
It is tomorrow. Yeah.
Okay.
Sooner than it sounds.
I would have hoped, Rob, that that date might be in your diary.
I think you better scribble it in as soon as we're off air, Andrew.
Yes.
What's happening? This is a radio broadcast service. Not everybody can come to our party. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Okay.
There are other people that will be traipsing the streets of London might want to go to the Royal Albert Hall. I'm doing
service. We need to invite them on at some time.
Yeah.
Some point.
I know. I thought they'd be great. And they clash.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
You listen to the Monocle Weekly. When we're back, our foreign editor is here, Steve Bloomfield. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly, where it's time for this week's monologue with our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield.
As the UK's Defence Secretary, Liam Fox, has just discovered, bringing friends along on work trips can cause problems. Fox was forced to resign this week after it emerged that his friend Adam Werrity, the best man at his wedding, had joined him on 18 overseas trips since Fox had become a government minister less than 18 months ago. But while Fox has now quit, surely the first person to resign in order to spend less time with their friends and family, his unusual travel plans raise an interesting question. When we travel abroad for work, why shouldn't we get to bring along a friend? Anyone who has had to head off on their own to a new city knows the problem. There's a whole new world out there to explore, but no one to enjoy it with. Eating alone is never fun, no matter how good the restaurant, and hitting the bars and clubs without a sparring partner is no better either. It's even worse if the city is exciting, a Tokyo or Milan, Barcelona or New York. How much better it would be if a girlfriend, boyfriend or best friend could come along for the ride. Bosses might argue they want their staff to be focused on the job in hand rather than the nightlife, but that's missing the point. Getting to know the spirit of a city, the culture of its people, the feel of the place, is going to give you a far better idea of the people you're trying to impress or the company you're about to go into partnership with. Granted, there's a chance you'll be more hungover in that crucial 9 a.m. meeting, but it's far better to have employees excited about going away on work trips than doing everything they can to get out of them. There would need to be a couple of ground rules, though. For a start, the friend has to pay their own way. Secondly, and here's where Dr. Fox's friend Mr. Werrity tripped up, they can't pass themselves off as part of the official entourage or use the connections to do a bit of business for themselves. So long as those rules are stuck to, I don't see the problem. But then I'm not a boss. Tyler, perhaps this is something we should think about. For Monocle, I'm Steve Bloomfield.
That was Monocle's very own Steve Bloomfield, who's going to be waking up quite early. Do you think he's already tucked into bed now?
That's an enduring image.
Now, you're not on air with us tomorrow, are you? Not early. I mean, you're going to be on air later in the day.
Yeah.
Andrew, you're around this table, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm going to be here. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm going to be here. Steve Bloomfield's going to be. We have a lot of guests. It's going to be a very, very busy morning.
I did want to kind of invite Rob onto the first show, but I didn't think he'd be here.
No.
He likes his pyjamas.
No, he's anchoring the back end of the day.
Yes, he's more kind of late night voice, I think.
Absolutely.
Always.
Well, I mean, to everyone listening, tomorrow is an incredibly big day. And depending on where you are around the world, you can tune in from 6 a.m. London time. We had a big discussion whether we'd be GMT or London time, but people never know when GMT is. I mean, they have to go look it up. So I think you just know what time it is in London.
And also people might think we're ordering a G&T.
They might, which you might even before.
That's
we're
why
on
I'm
air,
doing the fact. Evening show.
There should be a bar trolley that rolls in. Anyway, we're all going to be here from 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. Rob is going to be here later in the evening. I think your program goes on at 7 o'clock. The program's called Culture with Rob Bound. I don't know how you're the only person with your name in the program.
I don't know.
Culture with Rob Bound.
I know it's also like I think I don't know. It's a sort of big title, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like if it's not culture, it's not going in.
Well, might as well call it Rob. under Rob's big top.
Exactly. I'll be pitching my tent every week.
Every week with a couple of repeats as well, and I guess you'll be doing some other segments. But it's a very big day, and so 2 hours in the morning, and then we're gonna have a half hour update around midday with Matt Barbette. Then we have our very own Nancy Durham, who she's just been to Bishkek. She's going to be in doing Midori House, which is one of our other programs. And then I think I'm going to be sitting here, or maybe I might be in the seat to the right or the left. Then Christine O'Krent is co-anchoring with me all week, doing the Monocle Daily at 10 till midnight London time.
Yeah,
and do I need a special voice? 10 to midnight.
We don't go off air in between.
No, we don't. No, we've got we have other programs. One of the sort of the other comedy moments of the week was when we thought, well, we're launching the service, and I said to Andrew, I was looking at the schedule. We, of course, we've got all of the programs that have repeats, but because we haven't made any programs yet, we're thinking, goodness, we're stuffed for the beginning of the week. So it's going to be a lot of music and talk until we have a bank of programs. Anyway, Rob, your program's up first. There's also going to be Hugo with his design program. Jonathan Openshaw's got the entrepreneurs, and I'm going to be doing a program called The Menu. I think that's all the shows we have, in fact.
Your show.
Yes.
There's The Urbanist, which is probably the best show on the whole schedule. It's about the cities we live in and the people who make them better places to live and the more interesting people who live in our cities. What's good is cities.
Why are you making that face? You're even making a bragging face.
What's good is that, you know, cities kind of covers everything. So most stories have to come via The Urbanist, and we decide whether
we want
them or not.
It is like this enormous gaping hole in the middle of it, all sort of, you know, stories get sucked
like
into.
There's been a lot of story creep. There's been a lot of,
story creep. Because also, like, my goats almost ended up in the black hole.
I
nearly kidnapped the goat. Get it?
Exactly. Dear me.
Go and wash your face.
Anyway, if you want to find out more, you can look on our website for sure. And also, our new issue should be hitting the office very soon as well, which is going to feature a complete schedule that people can put up on their refrigerators or above their desks. They can laminate them, they can frame them, they can do all kinds of things.
Could you iron it onto a T-shirt?
You could. In fact, I think, actually, that's a great cue because, you know, there's M24 T-shirts as well.
Woo!
Yeah, three colors. Made in Los Angeles.
Nice.
Yeah, very nice. They have an armband, but in a nice way. I had to wear an armband. You know, I was in Japan this week.
And I know you were in Japan, but you were in Japan for 11 minutes. But why did you have to wear an armband?
Because you have to, the press corps always have armbands to wear. Because when there's a major event that you need to go to, so rather than, you know, like reporters of yore who had sort of the cap with sort of press on the side. You have a special armband. But this
quite
was
old school.
So it's actually rather than wearing sort of a silly name tag, you just safety pin it to your jacket.
Oh, right, because I thought you meant that when you went in the
I didn't go to some rally or
no,
something
no, I
like
thought you
that.
Went, when you do, when you just got in the Peninsula swimming pool, they made you wear your armbands.
No, goodness.
Only one. Just swimming around in circles.
Exactly. No, it's just my bathing cap when I'm there. Actually I was at another hotel this time. But it's a great segue as well, Andrew, to the Peninsula, because guess what did we open yesterday?
We opened a cafe.
Yeah, Monocle Cafe opened in Ginza Yurakucho in the new Hankyu men's department store, which is brilliant. I mean, you know, of all the markets, and of course, you know, we know that Japan's had a bit of a rough patch, but this is 8 floors of menswear. And they've copied what they've done in Osaka, where we also have a shop and shop. But now we have a 60-seat cafe with the sunniest, most lovely crew that you could imagine. Little shop in the back. And we've also got our friend from Moto Sonder Coffee making coffee there. But we'll have more on that program tomorrow. We might even have a live link across to Tokyo tomorrow, but you have to wait till 6 o'clock in the morning. And also 10 o'clock in the evening as well. But we're back tomorrow. I guess you'll hear a bit of music first before we sign on, but we'll be back at 6 a.m. tomorrow with our new program, The Globalist. 2 hours of fun and excitement.
And here we go.
There's a sharp intake of breath all around.
Exactly. Well, anyway, that's all for edition 121 of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Don Trump. Our sound engineer was Chris Sharp here at Midori House in London. But I also see that, I see Alex shrugging his head. Alex Funnell or Funnel was also manning the deck. It took two people today. And also, this is the last show of the current jingles, which is quite sad. We have a completely new, should we call it a suite of music, Rob?
I quite like a suite of music.
Yeah, we have a suite of music by the Quiet Nights Orchestra. And I think we mentioned many weeks ago that we had been working with them. And also they'll be here tomorrow as well. I think I hear their aircraft landing about now. They're going to be performing. We have some live elements as well with live music tomorrow too. Is that enough? Do you think we've teased this whole thing enough? I think we've worked it to death. Anyway,
I can hear a trombone tuning up.
And the goat.
Yes. And if you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. Remember, you can also read our Monocle column daily, but also we're going to be here 24 hours a day, and you can find us at monocle.com/24. But for me, in London, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Robert Band.
See you tomorrow. Goodbye.